On December 19, 1888, Horatius Bonar marked his 80th birthday. It would prove to be his last. As the early months of the following year passed, Reverend Bonar felt his formerly robust health began to give way. By the spring of the year, he realized that he was dying. Bonar had lived through a period that had gained a reputation for its wealth of biographical writing about Christian ministers and missionaries. It was his objective to prevent his life story from being added to that list. He was well acquainted with his brother Andrew's famous account of the life of Robert Murray McShane, whom the Bonars had known when they were young. That biography was possibly the best biography of a minister that had ever been written, or that would ever be written. But Horatius Bonar was of the spirit that led him to be anxious that the attention of others should be directed not to himself, but to Christ. He had written at one point, "If Christ is not the substitute, he is nothing to the sinner. If he did not die as the sin bearer, he has died in vain." He went on to say, "The very essence of Christ's deliverance is the substitution of himself for us, his life for ours." When Horatius Bonar died on July 31st, 1889, in Edinburgh, Scotland, anyone who may have been inclined to write a biography of him, in spite of his expressed wishes to the contrary, would have found that Bonar had left him a huge difficulty. Bonar had written many books during his life on various themes, but apparently he had destroyed all of his personal correspondence and any other documents that would have been useful to a potential biographer. Those things simply do not exist. It seems eccentric, I think you'll agree, to people today who live in the midst of the personality cult, when every week seems to bring us a story of some new personality who takes the fascination of the public. It seems strange to us that a man of Bonar's accomplishments, that to be sure go far beyond those of personalities who take attention today, should have been so anxious to avoid the notice by others after his death. But Horatius Bonar and his two illustrious brothers, John and Andrew, were men of a far different spirit than the Joel Osteens and Rick Warrens of our time. Those three men, whose lives filled most of the 19th century, devoted themselves to the Christian ministry, and each of them labored in that ministry for more than 50 years. It's doubtful if any group of three brothers has before or since compiled such a record. In their lifetimes, Andrew was easily the most prominent of the three. He was also the youngest of the three. But since their deaths, Horatius by virtue of the sheer volume of his writing, has become more well known, and Andrew not as well known, and John almost completely obscure. Horatius wrote numerous pamphlets and small booklets on a broad range of subjects, and we'll have occasion to consider some of those in future messages in this series. He also wrote poetry extensively. And you have to understand that in his writing of this poetry, it was something like that in the life of John Newton, who died almost exactly 1 year before Horatius Bonar was born. In those days, especially in the churches in Scotland, it was not the custom to use anything in public worship except for the Psalms. And so the writing of these poems was really done more on a private basis and more for private meetings for prayer. But such was the quality of the poems, some of which we have sung this evening, that through time, though not by the design of Horatius Bonar, the singing of hymns came to be added to the historic practice of the Scottish churches in worship. But at the heart of all, Horatius Bonar was known in his time as a faithful minister of Jesus Christ, laboring among the people in his charge for the conversion of their souls and for their edification in the way of faith. In that way, Horatius Bonar emulated the example of the apostles, whom the Lord Jesus Christ summoned to be fishers of men, in the passage that we read this evening, particularly in verses 18 through 22. You read, interestingly enough, of the Lord's call to two sets of brothers. And his call to them was, follow me, and I will make you fishers of men. And Bonar sought to emulate that example, to be a fisher of men. This evening, we're beginning a brief series of messages on the life of this servant of God. Now, we're going to consider on this occasion the early phases of his life and ministry, and then in subsequent messages, once each quarter in this year, we're going to examine the later phases of his ministry and his thought and his writing and the controversies in which he found himself engaged as his ministry unfolded. We'll look at those in greater detail later on. But for our purposes this evening, it is best to consider him in this character, called to serve Christ. Possibly the greatest lesson that we can learn from the early life of Horatius Bonar is that while he was born into a godly home, the godliness of that home did not suffice to bring his soul to saving faith. I think that's a powerful lesson, and he would be the first to share it, could he do so. There is no record, thanks to his destruction of all his correspondence and other documents, there's no record of the time when Horatius Bonar came to saving faith. But sometime apparently in his teenage years, he had to come to that day of reckoning for himself. His parents were godly. They were devout. But it wasn't enough for him. One of his contemporaries described the manner in which Horatius loved and honored his parents and certainly would not seek to do anything that would displease them. But this contemporary added that he did not and could not merely glide into their understanding. He read his way. He thought his way. He fought his way. He reasoned his way. He prayed his way to his anchorage in Christ. And that is that for Bonar, as for every single person, coming to Christ is an individual experience. We do not find Bonar or any of his siblings simply drifting along, waiting for something to happen. We find them taking all that their parents had taught them and all that they heard from the faithful preaching of the gospel in their church. But they considered all that with the recognition that no doubt their parents put before them all the time and that they heard from a faithful minister of Christ, that they had to come to faith in Christ individually. That the experience of their parents was not going to be sufficient for them. That the experience of their siblings was not going to be sufficient for them. Nevertheless, it was a great comfort to Horatius Bonar throughout his life that he had two brothers who were laboring along with him in the ministry. And it was a comfort to him because in the time in which they labored, there was a time of serious theological and ecclesiastical turmoil in the Scottish churches. There came a time when the Bonars and their mentor, Thomas Chalmers, of whom I have more to say shortly, had to lead a group of 400 ministers in the Church of Scotland to secede from that church rather than to go along with the continuing perversion of the gospel. In that time of turmoil, these three brothers, and this is even more remarkable, were all of the same mind on these issues. And they were devoted to the revival of Reformation doctrine and earnestness in the seeking of souls. That had been lost in Scotland. So this evening I want us to consider the early phase of Bonar's life until the time of his ordination and his installation in the pulpit of a new congregation in Kelso. There are three parts of this phase of his life to which I direct your attention. First of all, let's consider the family background. Horatius Bonar, or Horace, as the family called him, and that's how I'm going to call him, just for the sake of simplicity, for the rest of this message. Horace was born on December 19, 1808. As I pointed out, almost exactly 1 year to the day following the death of John Newton. Horace was born in what is now part of Edinburgh's New Town. During the 19th century, there was what you would call urban renewal in Edinburgh, and the part of Edinburgh from what is called Princes Street up to the toward the Firth of Forth, that was completely redesigned, and it to this day is a model of urban planning that students of urban planning go to study. Well, in the day in which Horace Bonar was born, there was a small parish in that area, and he was born there. It was not very far from the water, the Firth, or as the Scots call it, the Firth, the mouth of the Forth River. The Firth of Forth, it's called. There would be five sons in that family that would survive infancy. And I say that to point out that one of the reasons that families were large in that time was that so many children died, either before they could emerge from infancy or before they could reach adulthood, or even any semblance of it. Five sons survived infancy, and that was itself remarkable. Three of those five would become Christian ministers. There were also four sisters. This was quite a large family. One of the sisters, Marjorie, died when Horace was in his teenage years. So I think you can appreciate that one of the realities that confronted people growing up in that time was death. That siblings died, parents died. This was not an uncommon thing. It was still a tragedy in every case. And Bonar's later life would be marked by those tragedies. But it was a reality. And I think perhaps that reality imparted a great deal more sobriety and solemnity to people than is now the case. Horace's father was James Bonar. James Bonar was born in 1757. In his career, he was a lawyer, and he served as a solicitor in one of the civil government departments in Edinburgh. That was what he did for a living. But it was even more important that James Bonar was deeply interested in two things: literature and religion. His interest in literature was manifested in the fact that he would often be seen making his way with book in hand to the Firth of Forth, where he went almost every day to swim. Now, the water in the Firth of Forth is quite cold, even in the summertime, so you can imagine what that must have been like. Maybe that's why he only lived to be 64 years of age. I don't know. But he was also an elder in a church in Edinburgh known as Lady Glenorchy's Chapel. Now, let me tell you about Lady Glenorchy's Chapel. Lady Glenorchy was a noblewoman who was not happy about the state of religion in Edinburgh. She remarked on the fact that there was hardly any preaching of the gospel going on in Edinburgh. There was a lot of preaching of doctrine, even Calvinistic doctrine, but not much preaching of the gospel and very little in the way of appeals to people to come to Christ. And so she used her wealth and her station in society to build a church in Edinburgh, and she was allowed the discretion, because she had furnished the money to build the church, she was allowed the discretion to choose the minister, which is something she wanted to do. And she chose as the first minister of this chapel that was built in 1774, a Welshman by the name of Dr. Thomas Snell Jones. He became the minister of that church, and he continued there until his death more than 50 years later. So it's obvious that the Bonar brothers, as they grew up under his ministry, had an example before them of perseverance. The congregation that was formed in 1774, by the time that the Bonar brothers were born, numbered more than 1,000. Now, they probably had great difficulty heating the place, And you can appreciate that in Edinburgh, much of the year it's quite chilly and damp. So it is an amazing thing that more than 1,000 would be in attendance. The religious scene in Edinburgh during that time was marked by a departure from that which had been emphasized by the successors of John Knox and Andrew Melville. In Scottish history, in the memory of every Scottish Protestant, of course, would have been the Covenanting Times. The Covenanting Times ended in 1688. So that was just 120 years before Bonar was born. But by that time, they were a distant memory. All of the battles, all of the struggles of that period, all of the sacrifices that had been made during that period were forgotten. And what had taken its place was theological compromise. That is, de-emphasizing the things that cause people to be uncomfortable. Does this sound familiar? Introducing such drift that most churches no longer featured any urgent appeals for sinners to come to faith in Christ. It was, in Scottish Presbyterian history, a period that came to be known as moderatism, corresponding a century later to modernism. That is, this idea that we don't want to get too fanatical about anything to do with religion. And it would have appeared that, Lady Glenorchy's chapel notwithstanding, that trend would have continued. But in 1811, when Horace was only 2 years old, there was published in Edinburgh a biography of John Knox by Thomas McCree. And such was the sensation caused by this life of John Knox that people began to realize that what was being preached in most churches was far removed from anything to do with the ministry of Knox. Some men even said, I began to realize that there was in this book a much more attractive theology, or divinity as they were fond of calling it, than anything that they were hearing from the pulpits. Horace's father died in 1821. Horace was 12 years old. The oldest son of the household, James, began then to act as a replacement father for the family members who remained behind. And James, no doubt, undertook some direction in the life of Horace from that point on. For it was in that decade, the decade of the 1820s, that the direction of Horace's life began to be apparent. So that brings us to the second aspect of this early phase of his life, his educational training. During his school days, Horace, following no doubt his father's example, displayed a great aptitude for the understanding of literature. In fact, he was probably the star student in his grammar school, as it was called, understanding both English literature and classical literature. He was enrolled in Edinburgh University. It was common for people to enroll in the university by their middle teens, and so he enrolled there. And in 1826, when he was 17, he won a prize there in moral philosophy. The following year, he joined the editorial staff of a student publication at the university, and for the first time, some of his poems began to appear in print. Now, Horace Bonar never graduated from the university. Some people have wondered about that, but the fact was, in those days, there wasn't quite as much value placed upon having what is called a baccalaureate degree or an undergraduate degree or even a master's degree as would be the case now. But what happened was that his life took a different direction. For in 1828, when he was 19, when Horace Bonar was 19, a new professor began teaching in the university, particularly in the Divinity Hall. His name was Thomas Chalmers. Thomas Chalmers would go down as one of the most influential Scotsmen in history, because Chalmers taught a whole generation of ministers in the Divinity Hall, where students for the ministry were being educated. The following year, 1829, Horace entered that program and came under the influence of Chalmers directly. And it was the contention of Chalmers that the problems that existed in the Church of Scotland could only be addressed by a mighty revival and return to the old style of Reformation preaching. In January of 1830, Horace Bonar took the step of becoming a communicant member of the church in which he had grown up, Lady Glenorchy's Chapel. And later in that same year, his brother Andrew took the same step. Now, it was while he was in the Divinity Hall that Horace Bonar began to develop an interest in Christian missions that would color much of his life and ministry. He organized what was called the Visiting Society. And this was a society made up of a number of divinity students. And what they did was they covenanted with each other that they would spend some time every week engaged in missionary activity in the city of Edinburgh. And they resolved that they would go to those areas that were populated by the poorest and most careless people when it came to any spiritual interest. And each Saturday morning, these young men, would all gather in the home of Dr. Chalmers, and they would have a time of prayer, and then these young men would go out to this area, and they would visit among these people. And while they acknowledged it was extremely difficult work, they later all wrote they were glad that they had continued with it. It was through this work that Horace became deeply impressed with the need for ministers and Christian workers in Scotland. There was a great, for lack of a better word, romantic fascination with foreign missions. This was really the early days of foreign missionary activity. And there were people going out from the United Kingdom to remote parts of the world to do missionary work, and there was a sort of a romance about this. And Andrew, Horace's brother, was quite taken with the thought of going to one of these distant lands. But Horace impressed upon him that Scotland was in great need itself, that Scotland was itself a mission field, and that there was a need for Christian ministers and workers in Scotland, in the cradle of Presbyterianism. And so it came to pass that Horace himself came to the beginning of the service to which he was called. And with that, I come to the third part of this first phase of his life, first responsibilities. Horace eventually completed his studies in the Divinity Hall, and on April 27, 1833, when he was 24 years old, Horace was licensed by the Edinburgh Presbytery and was placed as an assistant to the minister of the church in South Leith. Leith was a part of the Edinburgh area. It was down along the waterfront. It was a port area. And as such, it was known for its rough living conditions and its even rougher inhabitants. The minister of the church, the Reverend James Lewis, assigned Bonar to work in a certain area of the town. And Bonar later recalled his early days there in this way. The district which he allotted to me had a population of more than 3,000. Its streets and lanes were among the very worst in the town. But the work soon became pleasant, and we were welcomed even by the worst and the wickedest. My commencement was of a peculiar kind. Mr. Lewis had secured a hall, which held about 200, in one of these lanes, and I was to occupy it every Sabbath, forenoon and afternoon, with the Sabbath school in the evening. It had hitherto been used by a small body of Roman Catholics. I had scarcely begun the forenoon service, and I take this to mean on the first day when he was preaching there, when the door was thrown open and a furious woman walked in shouting, "My curse and the curse of God be upon you." But there was no disturbance, and the curse did not come. But in many ways, both among old and young, the blessing followed. That was the starting point of my work in Leith. Now, it's easy for us to read that sitting here comfortably right now, but suppose you had been Horace Bonar, a young licentiate, just beginning in his work, and already having been somewhat acquainted with the roughness of the area where he was laboring, and there he finally gets to the first Sabbath day in this new hall, which was for the purpose of an outreach in that area, and the first thing that happens is a woman comes in great anger, to announce God's curse upon the place. That was the beginning of his work there in Leith. But it didn't dissuade him. He continued there for 4 years. Actually, more like 4.5 years. And the reason that he was so long there as a licentiate was that it was not unusual for the students of Thomas Chalmers to go a long time before they received calls to existing pulpits. And there was a reason for that. And the reason was that these men whom Thomas Chalmers had trained had established the reputation that they were going into churches where the people were sound asleep and they were disturbing their sleep. They were preaching sermons that were disturbing. And many church sessions had no interest in disturbing their parishioners in that way. They liked the comfortable existence that they had. So when it became apparent that, well, we have a vacancy in the pulpit, well, there's this young man. Well, how did he get his training? Well, he was in the Divinity Hall under Thomas Chalmers. No, we're not going to have him. He's going to come in here and stir things up, and we don't want to be stirred up. That was exactly the problem in the Church of Scotland. Now, Horace saw great things achieved, particularly in the Sabbath school, in the children's work. Again, it was not by his design, but simply by his manner, by the reputation he established, that by the time he left Leith, which was near the end of 1837, there were 283 children on the roll of the Sabbath school. And when he had started, there were none. So it was through his painstaking and careful perseverance that this work was established. But toward the end of 1837, a new congregation was formed in a place called Kelso. Kelso was located in the area of Scotland called the Borders. It was quite a ways from Edinburgh, probably about 50 miles away along the river that separated Scotland from England. He received the call to come and take up the ministry of this new congregation. And just before his 29th birthday, at the beginning of December in 1837, he was ordained to the ministry of the gospel. His brother Andrew wrote of the occasion, "Last Thursday, God permitted me to see Horace ordained at Kelso. At the moment of laying on of hands, I felt a strange thrill of solemnity and love toward him. The prayer was most excellent. I think the Lord was there." Horace Bonar had reached the formal beginning of his ministry for Christ. And all of the experiences, all of the preparation through which he had passed, had only been the means of getting him ready for this great work that would eventually see his influence extend around the world. Let us learn the lesson from his early days. And let us remember again tonight that salvation is an individual matter. Every person must come to Christ individually. And let us not take for granted the great blessing of growing up under the influence of the gospel. Not everyone has that blessing, but let none of our children here take it for granted this evening. To grow up with the gospel is a great blessing, but it is only a privilege. Salvation is something you must come to yourself. Be sure tonight then that you are saved, so that then you will be available to be called to serve the Lord Christ.